Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Okay, we've had a problem here. 13
Minutes to the Moon, Season 2.
I can't believe this. They're not going to land.
Episode 1, available now.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Emilio San Pedro, and at 14 hours GMT on Friday the 13th of March, these are our main stories. The English Premier League football season has been suspended due to the coronavirus, joining a long list of other sporting events hit by the pandemic. As European stock markets rebound after days of losses, the European Commission president outlines a package of measures to help Europe's economies. And
taking my children to see their pediatrician, it's like $100 each visit.
A report on the cost of healthcare for those who can least afford it in the United States. Also in this podcast,
emotionally it was a struggle, but spiritually it was peaceful, and mentally it made me stronger. The memory-wise, I remember her and I carry her memory with me all the time.
A year on from the Christchurch mosque shootings in New Zealand, we hear from a man whose wife was among those killed, and how two rival DJs in Ivory Coast used music to spread very different messages about how men should treat women. That's all coming up, but we begin here in Britain, where English football is facing unprecedented turbulence and disruption due to the coronavirus. All Premier League games, EFL fixtures and matches in the FA Women's Super League and Championship have been suspended until at least April the 3rd, joining a long list of prestigious world sporting events hit by the pandemic. The French Football Federation has announced similar action, and all European Champions League matches have been postponed. I asked our sport correspondent, Alex Capstick, what more we know about this unprecedented decision to suspend Premier League matches.
Well, we do know that the Premier League has acted independently from the government. The government hasn't yet advised for sporting events to be cancelled because of the coronavirus outbreak, but they've done this after a manager and a couple of players were infected. The Arsenal first team is in isolation because Mikel Arteta, their manager, he was infected. Callum Hudson-Odoi, who plays for Chelsea, said that he had caught coronavirus, so the Chelsea side is in lockdown. Everton and West Ham have also said that their first teams are in isolation. They're saying the Premier League action will resume on April the 4th at the earliest. That period does include a break for international fixtures, so England's game against Italy and then against Denmark, they have both been cancelled. Already, football in Italy, Spain, France, Switzerland, Denmark has been suspended, and in other countries. In Germany, they're going to play behind closed doors this weekend, but there's a meeting on Monday when they're expected to cancel as well. And as you mentioned, elsewhere in football, next week's Champions League matches, they're off. That was to be the concluding round of 16 games. They've been cancelled, so the quarterfinal draw won't take place at the end of next week.
So it's postponed till April the 3rd, but it could go longer, perhaps. What will the rest of the football season look like, and will there be knock-on effects on Euro 2020?
Well, yeah, the Premier League says its ambition is to reschedule the lost fixtures, and the English FA has said that they are committed to find a way of doing that. But I think given the worsening situation, the aim of resuming football in early April, that does look unlikely. I think privately it's understood that many people within football believe that as well. And that's because the outbreak is expected to peak in May and June. That could lead to some calls for the league to be declared void, which would be a terrible situation for Liverpool, who are so far ahead in the league. They're going to win the league. But if it's declared void, their long wait for an English Championship title will be over because the league will be void. They think they can get the fixtures in, maybe, because Euro 2020 might be cancelled. They're at UEFA a meeting next Tuesday, and it's understood there is an option that will be discussed to delay Euro 2020 by 12 months.
Alex Capstick, and still on the subject of sport, the world's most lucrative cricket tournament, the Indian Premier League, has been postponed until the middle of April. The Board of Control for Cricket in India said it made the decision as a precautionary measure against COVID-19. Our correspondent in Delhi, Kinjal Panja, has been following developments.
for the last 2 days, everyone was kind of asking whether IPL will happen, will not happen. So certainly this is not good news for all the cricket fans in India. But yes, it's a precautionary measure. And in terms of impact on cricket in India, we haven't really had a lot of reaction from people. People are still quite worried about the spread of coronavirus in the country. But in terms of revenues, it doesn't really impact so much because a lot of the revenues actually come from TV rights in IPL, and a very small margin of the revenue comes from ticket sales. So in terms of the economic impact, we are not going to see a big impact as yet because, you know, big money comes from the TV rights.
That's interesting. And how's India dealing with the outbreak in general of coronavirus?
Well, India has said that it was amongst the first countries in the world to prepare for an outbreak of this disease. And Indian military is running mass quarantine facilities in the outskirts of Delhi, where hundreds of civilians are under military supervision in quarantine. A lot of isolation wards have been opened. More and more number of states in India are announcing that schools, colleges and theatres will remain shut. We've already had this announcement from at least 4 states in India, and we are continuing to hear these kind of announcements. Last night, India had recorded its first casualty linked to coronavirus.
And what about other countries in the region?
Across South Asia, media has been reporting it very, very prominently, blanket coverage across the region. Bangladesh has cancelled its Independence Day march, which was scheduled for 26th March. And in Pakistan, Imran Khan, the Prime Minister, is chairing a meeting today to review preparedness for coronavirus. And in Sri Lanka, again, they have suspended visas on arrival for nationals of 48 countries. So all South Asian countries are on a big watch of what's happening in their own country and really preparing themselves.
Kinjal Panja speaking to me from Delhi. The president of the European Commission has been outlining measures to help its member states cope with the economic impact of the coronavirus. These include the creation of a 37 billion euro response fund. Ursula von der Leyen said it was vital that the EU acted in a unified way.
The single market has to function. It is not good when member states take unilateral action, because it always causes a domino effect, and that prevents the urgently needed equipment from reaching the patients, from reaching hospitals and the medical personnel. And ultimately, it amounts to reintroducing internal borders at a time when solidarity between member states is needed.
I asked our Europe correspondent, Kevin Connolly, who's in Brussels, what this fund will be used for.
Well, that's a very good question. And of course, we don't really have very much of that kind of detail yet, because I think the message the Commission was trying to get out today is really just that it is standing by with immense financial firepower to help the European economy weather the economic shock of coronavirus. So the money could be used to provide liquidity in sectors which are already immediately badly affected, like tourism and transport. It will allow airlines, for example, to maintain the slots that they own to operate between different international airports, where it's not currently economically worthwhile operating aircraft, for example. It might be allowed to be used to loan money to national rail companies, to large hotel chains, all of which feel the first wave of that economic shock. So the real message here is that the European Union is standing by with a huge amount of money to limit the economic effect while the epidemic works through, if you like. So what Ursula von der Leyen said was, you can't stop this virus, but you can slow the spread. And the signal she's sending to the markets is that while that process is underway, while the science is being worked through, there's a huge stockpile of money able to be deployed very quickly to help businesses which are already suffering.
And will this be seen as enough?
Well, if it's not seen as enough, there was a very clear signal that there could yet be more. Germany has already said that within the German economy, the government will lend money to keep businesses open. Ursula von der Leyen was very clear that if more money is required, it will be there. On top of that 37 billion euros already, we should say, there's an 8 billion euro fund. And the purpose of that is to make small business loans. So the word from the Commission is that as many as 100,000 businesses across the European Union could utilise that fund again very quickly, again to absorb the first wave of the shock.
Kevin Connolly, our Europe correspondent. Of all the promises made by the White House about the coronavirus, none has yet addressed what happens to the estimated 27 million people in the U.S. who don't have health insurance. Add to them the millions whose immigration status means they're scared to get medical help, and you have the potential for the spread of the virus being greatly exacerbated. Aline Makboul reports from Tucson, Arizona.
Lisa Rubio is collecting her daughter Ava from school in Tucson on the day the city's confirmed its first coronavirus case.
We were getting sick a lot, and taking my children to see their pediatrician, it's like $100 each visit.
Lisa's one of the tens of millions of Americans for whom the cost of health care is prohibitive.
For me to go see a doctor, I can't afford to take away from my bills, take away from my children's needs.
We're standing here outside one of our two mobile health vans. So in the van, we have a central area for drawing blood.
Ravi Gravoy-Shah runs a mobile health clinic that goes around Tucson to treat people who are in an even worse position. Those who are among the estimated 27 million Americans with no health insurance at all. Dr. Shah tries to see around 50 patients a week, but staggering numbers of Americans don't access healthcare at all.
I remember I never went to the doctors. My mom would always try to like treat it at home or something, but it was always a big roadblock.
Among them are those who are scared to seek medical help because of their immigration status, like Sebastian, who's 20 years old, who's been here since the age of 3, but doesn't have U.S. citizenship, one of the millions of so-called undocumented.
Being undocumented is hard in itself. Some medical facilities, you know, they have, sometimes they have to, you have to present yourself to authorities. And although, you know, maybe some of my family may not have criminal backgrounds, they may not be the first on the list, but they sure are undocumented. And that's what people are looking for right now. That is, scares me, that's for sure.
And even for those people who don't have immigration issues, Dr. Shah worries about the spread of coronavirus in a country notorious for people not taking adequate leave when they're ill, because there's no requirement to offer paid sick leave.
I'm worried for the communities that we're serving that will go to work because they have no other source of income and no other way to pay their food and bills and utilities.
And for all the talk in Washington about provisions for the vulnerable during this health emergency, some medics just aren't convinced.
I have not seen any evidence that anything is going to be different with the coronavirus. You know, for years and decades, we've been okay as a society, knowing that there's so many in our community who are uninsured or underinsured, and we've been okay, and we're going to pay the public health price because these individuals without access to care are going to get sicker, are going to spread the disease more frequently because they're not getting care, not isolating, not getting diagnosed and treated, and we're going to pay the public health price because of what our society is okay with.
Dr. Ravi Gravoy-Shah ending that report from Aline Makboul in Tucson, Arizona. Just over 100 years ago, in 1918, the world experienced one of the deadliest epidemics in human history. It struck at the end of the First World War and became known as the Spanish flu, even though the virus didn't originate there. The pandemic triggered profound changes in public health. So does it provide parallels with the coronavirus outbreak? Paul Henley spoke to Laura Spinney, writer and science journalist, who's the author of Pale Rider, A History of the Spanish Flu, and she began with some shocking statistics.
According to the estimates that most people work with today, because it is a little difficult to gauge, at least 50 million people died, possibly twice that, over 500 million people who were infected in the world, which was a third of the global population at the time.
Right, it's a huge thing, and its mark is still left a century on.
It is, because, for example, I mean, it had many long-term consequences, but for example, it absolutely decimated the generation that was in the womb at that time. So women who were pregnant when the Spanish flu struck had miscarriages and died at alarmingly high rates. So that generation that should have been born 9 months later, in many cases, was not. And if you think that we've only recently passed what their lifespans would have been, it had a very long shadow.
What kind of things did people know about germ transmission in 1918?
So germ theory had been invented, if you like, in the 19th century, but it was by no means broadly accepted across the globe. It was probably accepted in most of, you know, the wealthier Western countries, but not everywhere. And it's also important to remember that people were at the tail end of a very long and very bloody war, and they were rather psychologically worn down. So I think for all those reasons, it was much easier for people to find mystical and sort of fatalistic explanations for what was happening to them.
And there was a sense of social justice among some people, wasn't there, that poorer people were worst affected?
I think people don't realise, because we associate eugenics with the Nazis much later on and the disgraceful things they did. But eugenics was a fairly mainstream school of thought in 1918. And the corollaries of that were that people tended to blame the poor and the workers for diseases that they were vulnerable to, mainly because they lived in bad accommodation and worked hard and ate poorly. So there was a sense of that's your fault. When you get ill, it's your fault. Rather than, you know, treating everybody as equally vulnerable.
Even the rich soon realised, though, that things had to change.
Yes, because everybody is vulnerable to a disease like flu. Even if your immune system is down because, for example, you're malnourished, you're more vulnerable. So that's where you start seeing the idea of needing to treat a pandemic as a social problem. And things like universal healthcare, socialized medical systems like our national health system, they had already been touted, but they got a big stimulus from this pandemic, the idea that everybody needs to be treated free at the point of delivery. But another thing that we saw in 1918 was an extraordinary effect of what psychologists call collective resilience. So if you think that in a pandemic, when a highly contagious infectious disease is on the rampage, probably your best bet is to steer clear of everybody else and isolate yourself. That's what we're being told to do now, of course, so that the disease cannot spread. But in fact, what people did sort of irrationally in a way, but it's also rather heartwarming, I suppose, is they reached out to each other to help each other. And of course, when you're ill, you do need support. So it's not a completely negative effect, but it probably didn't help in terms of slowing disease transmission.
Laura Spinney, writer and science journalist, speaking there to Paul Henley. And just to remind you, the BBC World Service is bringing you a daily roundup on the spread and implications of coronavirus with reports from affected areas and the latest medical information. So to hear what the global effects are on health, business, sport and travel, go to bbcworldservice.com for the coronavirus global update. You're listening to Global News, the best stories, interviews and on-the-spot reporting from the BBC World Service. Every weekend you can hear a review of the week's main news stories and why they matter. That's In the World This Week, and Caroline Wyatt joins me now to tell me what's in the latest edition.
In the week that coronavirus was declared a global pandemic, we'll hear from an Italy in lockdown and discuss whether governments are prioritising their nation's health or their wealth, and if it's possible to safeguard both. Russia and Saudi Arabia start an oil price war, sending prices crashing. What impact will that have on shale gas producers in America? And going viral, fake news about the pandemic, and where to find the real stuff, perhaps right here.
Thanks, Caroline. And that's all in the world this week, broadcast on Saturdays and Sundays and available to download from our website, bbc.co.uk/programmes. And still to come in this edition of our own podcast.
The king trashed the entire palace. He was carrying a machete, a crowbar and also an axe. And he also attacked other members of the family, and his own son had to call the police on him.
Why a South African traditional leader is in the news. New Zealand's Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, has said the country has fundamentally changed since the Christchurch mosque attacks 1 year ago. 51 people died when a gunman attacked two mosques last March. Ahead of the anniversary, hundreds of worshippers from the mosques attended a joint prayer meeting at the Horncastle Arena in the city, and Shaima Khalil was there.
This was unlike any other Friday prayer gathering for people here. It was about remembering the lives lost and a country coming together. In a large sports arena, worshippers from both Al Noor and Linwood mosques were joined by other members of the Muslim community who've travelled from different cities. It's been a year since the worst terror attack in New Zealand's modern history, and the day is bringing back many painful memories. After prayers, I meet Nuraini Abbas Milne. She and her son Sayad were at Al Noor Mosque when the gunman opened fire. The 14-year-old was killed, His mother tells me it's been a difficult year for her and Sayad's brother and sister.
No, we didn't talk a lot, but we know that all of us are at that time grieving in our own way.
Fareed Ahmed lost his wife, Husna. She was guiding women and children to safety during the attack and was shot dead as she ran back into the mosque to help her husband, who uses a wheelchair.
Emotionally, it was a struggle, but spiritually, it was peaceful, and mentally, it made me stronger because I have got my freedom not to be afraid, and I have chosen not to be afraid. The memory-wise, you know, I here or there or everywhere, I miss my wife, you know, I love my wife, I pray for her, you know, personally, in gathering. So, you know, I remember her and I carry her memory with me all the time.
Earlier, the Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern reflected on how this massacre affected the country. She also acknowledged that right-wing extremism was still a real threat here.
I believe New Zealand and its people have fundamentally changed. I can't see how you could have an event like this and not. But the challenge for us will be ensuring that in our everyday actions, in every opportunity where we see bullying, harassment, racism, discrimination, calling it out as a nation, that is when we'll show that we each individually have a role to play in making sure New Zealand has fundamentally changed for the better.
This attack shocked New Zealand. It also inspired a strong expression of solidarity here. But the sense of safety and immunity from terror has been lost in the peaceful city of Christchurch.
Shaima Khalil reporting. Regal behavior is pretty much understood to be dignified, composed, and diplomatic. What then to make of a South African king who's just been arrested on suspicion of trashing his own palace and assaulting other members of his family? And it's not the first time this particular monarch has had police attention. Our Africa correspondent Nomsa Maseko told me more about this king and what he's alleged to have done.
Well, it would appear that King Dalindyebo has an axe to grind with his son, who is also the acting king, Azenati Dalindyebo. It's understood that the king came into the palace in the early hours of this morning looking for his son that he has refused to speak to since he was released from prison in December, and tried to attack the acting king, who managed to escape through a window. But then the king trashed the entire palace. He was carrying a machete, a crowbar, and also an axe. And he also attacked other members of the family, and his own son had to call the police on him. And that is why he got arrested this morning.
And can you illustrate for us what it means to be the king of the Aba Tembu people?
Well, Aba Tembu are of the same clan as the late former president Nelson Mandela and also the likes of Walter Sisulu. So a very influential part of the Xhosa clan here in South Africa. It represents nearly a million people. And that is who the king is supposed to be representing. And also in terms of chieftaincy in South Africa, kings in South Africa also have a lot of say, particularly in rural areas where they mostly govern, because that is where the president of this country would get what is going on in a particular province, because a king needs to be reporting to the president about what is going on. But this king, unfortunately, has not been that to South Africans.
No, and he's been in trouble with the law before, Nomsa.
Indeed, because he kidnapped a woman and her six children, and he also set their home on fire and beat up four members of that family, one of whom died because one of their relatives had failed to present himself before the king's traditional court. This was back in the 90s, but he was eventually found guilty in 2014 and was sentenced to prison for 12 years and was then released through a presidential pardon 3 days before Christmas last year.
Nomsa Maseko, our Africa correspondent. Ivory Coast has gone through political turmoil in recent years, though its economy is growing fast. But one thing is a constant, the creativity and humor of the country's musicians. In recent weeks, a musical battle has been watched millions of times online. It all started when DJ Leo released a track called Donne-lui l'argent, an instruction to men to give money to their girlfriends or wives, which prompted a reply from a rival DJ. James Copnell has been speaking to both of them.
enfants des gens, donne-lui l'argent. Tu sors avec enfants des gens, donne-lui l'argent.
Bon, le message que je veux faire passer.
The message I want to get across is that men must take care of women, because women are the most beautiful of God's creatures. She's at our side to guide us.
Vraiment nous guider.
And taking care of women for you, that means giving her money, giving her a car, giving her a house.
Non, ça va au-delà de tout ça.
No, it's more than that. Women have no price. When I say in the song, if you can, I'm not forcing anyone. You can only give what you are able to. But if you have lots of cars and your wife is walking to work, that's not normal.
C'est pas normal. Regarde ses cheveux comme c'est mélangé. Donc quand les gens me voient dans la rue,
when people see me in the street, some of them say, hey, you betrayed us. I say, how? You should just give money to women. In the song, I say, if you don't have money, she should understand you. But if you have money, you have to give. You have to give pleasure to the one you say you love. So I didn't betray you. And generally, the people laugh.
And one of those laughing, you might even say gently mocking, is an up-and-coming star, Suspect 95. He released this track, telling DJ Leo in no uncertain terms that he had a very different view.
The message of this song is to tell women that they shouldn't just wait for money from their husbands. They shouldn't just be dependent on their husbands. They should themselves contribute to the house's expenses. That's what makes their charm. There's nothing more beautiful than an independent woman. Being an independent woman doesn't mean you don't need a husband. It just means she is herself able to make money.
Have people reacted to your song, your musical battle with DJ Leo?
It's generated a lot of reaction on social media. When DJ Leo brought out this song, loads of people didn't agree, and that generated a lot of messages on my social networks.
That report from Ivory Coast was by James Copnell. Well, it's time now for News from Elsewhere, our weekly look at some of the less reported stories from around the world. And with me in the studio is Crassie Twigg from our BBC monitoring team, which follows media around the world in many different languages. Well, Crassie, not surprisingly, it's all about coronavirus from you this week. Tell us what caught your attention.
Well, we've been monitoring all this panic buying around the world for a while. Face masks, sanitizer, toilet paper. In fact, I've learned a new word in German. It's called Hamsterkaufen because of hamsters stuffing their cheeks. And in Italy, there's a pasta crisis and a debate about pasta. Of course, it's never just about pasta. In Italy, it's about history and regional identity. So what's been happening? Italians have been posting pictures on social media of empty shelves where the pasta normally is, with one notable exception: penne lisce, boxes of penne lisce still being available to buy. This is the smooth penne without ridges. And this has been seen by some as a validation of the popular idea that penne lisce is not very good and nobody really wants to buy it, even in times of national emergency. That has upset lovers of penne lisce who say, no, you don't need ridges to the pasta, you know, with good pasta and good sauce, that's all you need. And one person even joked on Twitter that things might be so bad that Italians might have to even start buying penne lisce.
And next, you've got an amusing story about an Iranian tourist becoming an unlikely celebrity in Georgia because of the virus.
That's right. Well, he discovered he had coronavirus while visiting Georgia. And his fame started with one clip that was shown by Georgian TV that went viral subsequently. In it, he's seen talking to reporters outside a hospital, declaring himself virus-free. But then you see a couple of nurses wearing protective clothing bursting out of the building and ushering him away. So he was placed under quarantine in a hotel. He killed the time by posting video updates, which were very popular. Lots of people viewed them. In one of them, he urged people to help fund the treatment of a cancer patient. In another, he sang an emotional Iranian love song. So you can see why, you know, young, good-looking guy who can sing, that endeared him to his new fans. So his quarantine ended, but he can't go back to Iran just yet because the border is closed, so he is sticking around. He was invited to take part in a popular TV show where the host hinted that he'll even get invited to take part in the local version of Dancing with the Stars.
Well, thank you very much for that, Krassi Twigg of BBC Monitoring, for bringing us this week's news from elsewhere. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this edition or the topics we covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Emilio San Pedro. Until next time, goodbye.